You're listening to The Signal Daily. Hi, I'm Shorbury, your host for The Signal Daily podcast. And this is the episode for 19th April 2024. For the first story, we're looking at China cracking down on people with bad debts and expanding its dystopian social credit system to punish citizens with poor financial histories. As the country grapples with a housing market downturn, slowing growth and economic challenges. And in our main story, we dive into the monsoon predictions by the IMD that came earlier this week. What would an above-normal monsoon mean for rural incomes and the food economy? We talked to agricultural policy expert Devinder Sharma about this in today's episode. It's going to be a longer than usual episode, but do stay tuned till the end. If you are in China and have poor credit history, forget vacations or even riding high-speed trains, let alone staying in nice hotels. It's your punishment for not managing your finances properly. According to the Wall Street Journal, Beijing is coming down hard on debtors, taking away their pay, blocking them from government jobs and limiting their air travel. One can't even buy insurance for that matter. And if folks don't play by the government's rules, then they could end up in detention too. And Chinese courts can also blacklist citizens who don't comply with court orders to repay debts or cooperate with legal processes. In fact, since late 2019, the number of individuals on the government's public delinquency blacklist has spiked by nearly 50%, now standing at 8.3 million. But you might wonder, what's causing this rise in debt in China? Well, when the country's housing market was booming, it led many to take out loans to buy homes and some even borrowed extra to invest in multiple properties. However, with the ongoing housing market crisis, many are finding it increasingly difficult to pay back those debts. Now, China's government is trying to address the downturn by assisting struggling real estate firms by lowering borrowing rates and tackling local government debt problems. Yet, the roots of China's debt woes extend beyond just the real estate sector. Another major factor has been the rapid growth of consumer lending fueled by proliferation of credit cards and the expansion of fintech platforms. In fact, in the recent years, banks have been handing out millions of new credit cards annually, causing outstanding credit card balances to surge by over 50% between 2018 and 2023, now topping $1 trillion. And popular digital app payments like Alipay and WeChat have also aggressively pushed consumer lending products. So this flood of consumer credit, combined with a cultural shift towards more materialistic aspirations, has encouraged many Chinese to take on debt to fund lifestyle purchases and discretionary spending. The lack of a robust social safety net has also led some to rely on borrowing to cover medical expenses or other unexpected costs. Meanwhile, China's main stock index has lost around a third of its value, and the broader economy faces challenges including low consumer confidence, sluggish private investment, and high youth unemployment. So why is the Chinese government so strict in its treatment of debtors? Well, that boils down to the country's conservative nature and its implementation of the social credit system. Launched in 2014, this system tracks people's behavior and trustworthiness. And any misstep, be it jaywalking to skipping a fine, potentially results in lost privileges like booking a flight. And this surveillance setup is just one piece of China's broader efforts to monitor and control its citizens. But anyway, can China bounce back from this doomsday-like situation with an aging workforce, strained relations with the US, and a housing construction crisis? Well, the path forward is far from certain. For our second segment, we are going to bring you deep dives on stories from the world of technology, business, policy, and anything that leaves you with food for thought. After a prolonged dry spell, some good news has come for India's agricultural sector. So earlier this week, the Indian Meteorological Department, or the IMD, predicted that India is likely to receive above normal rainfall during the upcoming June-September southwest monsoon season, barring some areas over the northwest, east and northeast India, where below normal rainfall is expected. Not to be dramatic, but in the past few years, Indian monsoons have been held hostage by climate change and the El Nino effect that brought drier conditions to tropical regions like South Asia. But that is neutralizing. And the La Nina effect is kicking in, which is going to create conditions for steady rainfall in the subcontinent. Now, there will be a much clearer forecast in May, but it's still a big deal because This is the first time in nearly 8 to 9 years that the IMD has forecast above normal rains in the country. And I don't need to tell you how important monsoons are for India, where agriculture is about 15% of the GDP and lends to food security. So, southwest monsoon, which contributes about 70 to 90% of India's total annual rainfall, coincides with the cultivation of rain-fed kharif crops like rice, maize, millet, ragi, various pulses, oilseeds and cotton, jute and sugarcane. But as you know, the agricultural output has been rather volatile for the past few years. I mean, the country experienced extreme weather events almost every day in the first 9 months of 2023, leading to loss of lives and property, crop failure, rise of new pests, water scarcity in reservoirs, increased food costs, and decreased agricultural yields. Also, do remember that India is among the top producers of crops like wheat, rice, pulses, etc. And because of low harvest, prices of essential commodities have also been spiking. So in order to tackle domestic prices, wheat and non-basmati rice, onion and sugarcane, all of that had to come under export curbs or bans. That in turn put a lot of pressure on global food supplies. So these bans also impact India's credibility as a global supplier of food grains. But more importantly, these discussions on Indian monsoons inevitably steer the conversation towards rural incomes and agricultural productivity, because the agricultural sector employs nearly half of the workforce, and low incomes impact farmers' ability to take credit for investing in their land holdings. Now, a good monsoon is supposed to drive up rural earnings of farmers and farm laborers and increased rural demand for products and services and cool down food inflation. But some agricultural experts argue that actual incomes of farmers have been stagnant. At the same time, fewer employment opportunities have also increased the demand for rural jobs under the MNREGA scheme. So to get more insights into all this, I called up agricultural policy expert Devinder Sharma. Thank you so much, sir, for talking to me for the Signal Daily podcast. So my first question, as we talk about monsoon, the conversation obviously shifts to agriculture. Can you explain to our listeners how monsoons and agricultural productivity are intrinsically linked to each other? Does a good monsoon mean good news for India's food economy and India's farmers? Would that impact their incomes?
Well, considering that more than 50% area of India is rain-fed, it is quite evident that monsoon plays a very significant role in kharif production. And subsequently, because of the moisture that remains in the soil, it also benefits the rabi production, which is the winter crops. The monsoon is good, the country's agriculture performs better, and that is the foundation for the country's economy. Whether good monsoon is an indication that the country's food economy would benefit in the sense that the farmers would get a better income, because productivity is an issue. Let me make it very clear. This question is often asked to me that a good monsoon means a good income for farmers, but I don't really agree with that. The reason is that a good monsoon means a good crop, and a good crop means the price is crashing at the time of the harvest. So we have seen in the last 75 plus years after independence, and even prior to that, that whenever there has been a good monsoon, the prices don't, or let's say the income doesn't seem to have come down, given the greenery all around. But the benefit hasn't really passed on to farmers. If it was so, I see no reason why the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, which is the richest trading bloc in the world, in a study has said that Indian farmers, after the year 2000, which means for 24 years now after 2000, and prior to that, they were not doing that kind of a study for assessing the producer subsidies in 54 major economies of the world, including 37 of the OECD countries. And they have found that Indian farmers are the only farmers in the world who have been continuously incurring losses since the year 2000. Yeah. Well, I'm sure you will agree that in the last 22 years, the rainfall has been quite good at number of years. Mm. And yet, if the farmers have been incurring losses year after year, I think our understanding that the greenery all around will bring higher prices to farmers or higher income to farmers was certainly flawed.
In that case, would crop insurances, like, say, a legal guarantee for MSP, be able to allay this concern? Or actually, how would you balance that out with what organizations like WTO have been demanding? Should there be no export bans on food grains at all to counter that? What would be your take on all of this? I mean, what are we missing when it comes to securing farmers' incomes?
Well, we are missing is in the 54 countries that the OECD has done an assessment, you know, all countries are, you know, being, or farmers in all countries are being backed by subsidies or by government support. But still, there are three countries actually which are in the negative zone, and that is Argentina, Vietnam and India. Unfortunately, India is the only country where the losses are not covered up by budgetary support. And in even in Vietnam and Argentina, the losses are covered up by budgetary support. You know, if the you know, the gap, that the shortfall after the prices are paid to farmers, whatever is left, the losses are covered up. In India, it is the only country where farmers are left to pay one grosse. So I have always been of the opinion that what we really need is to make or provide farmers a guaranteed price.
So as I understand, a lot of people look at sales of tractors and sales of two-wheelers as key indicators of the health of the rural economy. In the rural market, FMCG sales and sales of two-wheelers were down. But interestingly, tractor sales saw a record high in FY23. So how do we understand, how do we decode this contradiction when we're looking at declining farmer incomes and increased demand for MGNREGA jobs as labor is shifting back to farming from manufacturing?
I think, again, a wrong assessment. Why I'm saying this is, let's be very clear. You know, between 2000 and 2016, a period of 16 years, the OECD tells us that Indian farmers lost 45 lakh crores. The point I'm trying to make is, why do we have to look at the rural economy through the prism of corporate size? The two-wheeler sale, the four-wheeler sales or tractor sale is an indication of how the country's economy is performing in the rural areas. Is the OECD study wrong? If it is wrong, why don't we challenge that study? After all, OECD is the richest trading bloc. They run the world. And if they are saying that Indian farmers are incurring losses year after year, and we are measuring the farm income by tractor sales in this manner, it shows we are short-sighted. If you look at the National Statistical you know, Survey report, you know, NSO, the latest situational assessment survey for agriculture household, which was a study done in 2019 and came out in 2021, tells us very clearly that the farmer is at the bottom of the pyramid. The average farm income in the country is 10,218 rupees. That's for agriculture household.
Yeah.
And I think we need to really go down to the brass tack and see why farmer income is not you know, on an upswing or is not increasing.
Okay, so my last question to you would be, what kind of long-term policy focus do we need to look at to sort of minimize the impact of erratic monsoons on farmers? I ask this because even though we have a prediction for good monsoons this year, the IPCC reports indicate that we need to really brace ourselves for extreme climate change events. So how do we preserve water? What kind of innovative strategies, irrigation strategies should we look at, and what kind of cropping patterns should we work on?
There is no denying that the climate change is going to pose another bigger problem in the years to come. It is already post-agriculture into a crisis in one part of the country or the other. And we also know that because of the heat that the agriculture sector is receiving because of the climate variation, farm incomes are dwindling. We are aware of that. We also know that in the years to come, the the greenhouse gas emissions coming from agriculture is roughly one third of the total greenhouse gas emissions, which leads to climate change. Mm-hmm. And which means the world has to move away from intensive agriculture to agroecological farming systems. And this is another development that the country must shift the focus to. But primarily, I think what the world, I would say, farming world, you know, farmers everywhere in the world actually are dying or are quitting agriculture because they have been denied the rightful income. Whether it is European Union, we know 24 countries faced farmers' protest and they are jet landing again to come back onto the streets, the farmer unions. In America, there has been a protest over the years, and they demand what is called as income parity. Income parity in America means what the Indian farmers are protesting and demanding as a guaranteed price for their produce. Yeah. So everywhere in the world, farmers are suffering because they have been denied the right for income. And I think if we have to understand, we have to look at the economic design the world follows, which is based on you know, the understanding that as long as more people stay in agriculture, it will continue to pull down the economic growth. Well, this has outlived this thought process. 56 million people in India have gone back to agriculture, demonstrating that all these neoliberal economics hasn't worked. Yeah. So I think it is very clear that if we really want to switch over, as you rightly said, to innovations, to agriculture, rebuilding agriculture, then I think here is an opportunity. Here is an opportunity. And what steps we need, I think first it should start with farmers' income.
And with that, I'll wrap up today's episode. If you like listening to The Signal Daily, please show some support. Rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. We'd love to hear what you have to say about this podcast. So feel free to shoot an email at hello@thesignal.co. This episode was researched, written and produced by me, Shorbury and Manaswini. Edited by Venkat Anand. Mastered and mixed by Yash Hirve. You can catch this podcast every morning on Spotify, Apple, Amazon Prime Music, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. We are thesignal.co on Instagram, LinkedIn, and Twitter.